Helium is the second lightest element, and it's the second most abundant element in the observable universe, being present at about 24% of the total elemental mass, which is more than 12 times the mass of all the heavier elements combined. And yet, there's currently a serious global shortage of the gas. This may not seem like much of a problem if you think of helium as simply the stuff you put into balloons or use to make your voice sound funny, but helium is essential for MRI machines and scientific research in general. And to learn more about how we've arrived at this situation, we have invited to this week's edition of Please Explain Dr. Martin Stutta, professor of environmental science at Barnard College and adjunct senior research scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University, and Joe Peterson, the Federal Bureau of Land Management's assistant field manager for helium resources in the Amarillo, Texas field office. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Stutta, what is helium? Why is it listed as atomic element 2 on the periodic table?
So it is the top element of the right column in the periodic table that we all have seen in school, and it's a noble gas. So all these elements in that column are called noble gases. Other noble gases are neon, argon, krypton, xenon, and radon, and helium is the lightest of those.
And why is it given the name noble?
It's called a noble gas because it doesn't interact much with other elements. It doesn't like to form chemical compounds. You know, atoms consist of a nucleus in the center, which have protons and neutrons in them, and then there are electrons in shells that are surrounding this nucleus. And these shells of electrons surrounding the nucleus have various numbers of electrons in them. And the more, and every element or every shell likes to have a certain number of electrons in it. And when it doesn't have the right number of electrons, it likes to exchange electrons with another atom. And that is a chemical reaction, and it forms molecules. Now, the noble gases have shells where all these electrons are, all the places are taken. So they are full of electrons. So they don't really want to exchange any electrons. So they're really happy on their own, and they don't want to mingle with anybody else. So they're just staying on their own. They don't form molecules and don't react chemically.
So hydrogen and oxygen are obviously not noble elements because they combine to create water, among other things.
That's right. Correct.
Mr. Peterson, what are some of the most distinctive characteristics, the qualities of helium that make it so important in the universe?
Well, it's one of the first things that you mentioned. I was talking about the fact that it's inert. It does not like to react with any other chemical. So that's one of the things that's really its most famous property. You know, the fact that if you have it in a situation where oxygen exists, you know, it won't start fires or it could potentially even put out a fire if the right concentration of helium is there.
Unlike hydrogen, which was originally used in blimps and was highly flammable, helium is not flammable at all.
Not at all. No.
It also can be, its temperature can be lowered to, 3 degrees above absolute zero?
Yes.
We'll get to that in a moment. Dr. Stutta, why does its inert quality make it so valuable to us? How is it used in research, for example?
So in research, it's used in instruments as a carrier gas, for example, in gas chromatographs, where you would like to measure the elemental abundances of gases. And to carry this gas, you want to measure for the instruments. Helium is being used there. But also, helium is a very important measurement to do in the environment because it tells us something about the dynamics of groundwater flow, for example, or how quickly ocean waters mix. It tells us something about the interactions between the Earth and cosmic dust particles, for example. So it's a tool that can be used to answer lots of different research questions.
How do we detect it?
It's detected these days mostly with mass spectrometers. So these are instruments that take helium and put it into a vacuum, and then electrons are shot at the helium atoms, and you make ions out of them, and they get accelerated in this instrument. and then a magnetic field is separating all these different gases in the mass spectrometer, and then they hit a detector, and you can count the individual atoms.
Are there different kinds of helium? I've heard of something called helium-3, helium-4. Mm-hmm. Are they distinct substances?
So we talked about the nucleus and the electrons early on in this program. The helium has two different isotopes, and the difference between them is that they have different nucleus. One of them, helium-3, consists of two protons and one neutron, and helium-4 consists out of two neutrons and two protons. So it's just a different weight, but to the outside, they look the same.
And do they function in the same way?
They function in similar ways because, you know, the chemistry is not affected by it because that's all controlled by the electrons. But they have different weights, for example, and they at very low temperatures, they have different properties.
We're talking about helium and why there's suddenly a shortage of the second most abundant element in the universe. On today's Please Explain with Dr. Martin Stutter, Professor of Environmental Science at Barnard College and Adjunct Senior Research Scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, and with Joe Peterson, the Federal Bureau of Land Management's Assistant Field Manager for Helium Resources in the Amarillo, Texas field office. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. If you want to join in the conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org. Mr. Peterson, where's most of the helium located on Earth?
Well, that's a very good question. There is a very great reserve in the United States. As a matter of fact, from the 1930s up until about now, to about 2010, one of the largest fields in the world was the Huguenot and Panhandle Field, which covers Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas. That field was the greatest supplier, or has been the greatest supplier of helium since the 1930s.
And why there? Isn't that where there also were a lot of petroleum reserves?
Yes. Indeed.
So would Saudi Arabia have a lot of helium as well?
Saudi Arabia does have helium, or let me put it this way. In the Middle East, there is a lot of helium. However, the thing that allows helium to be produced there is the fact that there is so much natural gas there, and the helium is contained in the natural gas, just like it is in the Huguenot Field. Low concentration of helium, but a major producer of natural gas. So there is an economy of scale that takes place.
And why are they often together, whether it's petroleum or natural gas and helium? We're talking about helium, which we find all throughout the universe. Is that helium all that different than the helium that we find below the Earth's surface?
Well, the main difference between the two is the fact that the ones below the Earth's surface was able to be captured. Because of the smallness of the atom, the helium has a tendency to escape. You know, another one of those properties is that it can go through any small hole anywhere in the Earth's surface. However, in those areas where it's trapped, you know, there is some sort of geologic structure that allows it to be captured, and that's what happens. That's what allows it to concentrate in those gas fields. Again, very small concentrations. You're talking less than 0.2, 0.3% helium in the natural gas reservoir. However, the fact that there is so much there means that it can be produced economically.
Dr. Stutter, somebody told me that helium that we mine is really deteriorating radioactive material. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. So, as Dr. Peterson pointed out, some of the helium we find in the Earth is helium that was trapped at the time when the Earth formed, billions of years ago. But most of the helium that we're actually using these days is helium that's produced in the subsurface. when you look at elements such as uranium and thorium, they are radioactive and they decay. And there are different kinds of decays, alpha, beta, and gamma radiation that's emitted through these decays. And alpha particles are nothing else than helium-4 nuclei. So these, when an uranium atom decays, produces an alpha particle, then this alpha particle just captures some electrons and it forms a helium-4 molecule. So most of the helium that we are using is produced this way. So it's constantly being made by radioactive decay.
When, Mr. Peterson, did people start making use of helium? What were some of the most important early uses?
Well, in just after World War One, about 1917, thereabouts, the United States discovered that there were some particular interesting applications for helium. They would use helium as a lift gas. The thing that made it so wonderful was the fact that even though it was at the end of the war, they were able to fill a balloon and get a very good overview of the war front, and able to tell the soldiers where the enemy was headed, which direction they were going, and they were able to do some strategic planning that way.
So it was seen as something that would be valuable to the military.
Exactly. As World War One ended, there were more interesting uses of helium that were developed. As a matter of fact, one of the first ones was the development of helium for, well, from about 1917 to about 1920, 1921, we were beginning just to discover more locations where helium could be found in the U.S. And the United States government decided that helium had some properties that were very interesting, some things that we needed to recover this helium and see if we can develop additional uses.
Now, to the general public, helium is what we party balloons keeps party balloons up. In fact, unfortunately, in some cases, causes little kids to lose them as they fly high into the sky. Also, is something that some people like to breathe in deeply, like this.
We discussed.
And then
that.
We have that funny voice. Now.
That is possible. That is one of the uses for helium, but we often, or actually, we need to discourage the use of helium in that way.
Well, this is decaying radioactive material. Did I just do something to my lungs?
Well, no, it's not really a problem with the radioactivity.
I'm about to cough.
The problem is that there is a possibility that your lungs can implode from doing that.
I'll never do it again. Yeah, but why does it have that effect on our voices, Dr. Studa?
It is because of the speed of sound. It's dependent on the gas, and it's the speed of sound is much higher in helium than it is in air, and that makes the frequency of your voice much higher. And actually, helium, people do breathe helium. Divers, for example, use mixtures of oxygen and helium when they have to dive to very large depths, because it's much easier on the body, and the danger of getting the bends when divers come back to the surface is reduced significantly if they use this helium mixture.
And when did they figure that out? Because people used to get the bends.
I don't know who came up with this idea.
Well, whoever did is pretty smart.
Right, I think it was in the 20s, and they were using helium. Actually, they were using helium for breathing treatments at the time, and someone came up with the idea of using it to see if they can go deeper. They realized that the problem with the bends was that the nitrogen from the air would come out of your bloodstream. You know, you have nitrogen dissolved in your bloodstream. When you get to a certain depth, get close to the surface, that nitrogen would immediately come out of your bloodstream, and that's really what the bends are, that nitrogen trying to escape back into the atmosphere. But with helium replacing the nitrogen, just a helium-oxygen mixture, there is no helium to be dissolved into. I mean, no nitrogen to be dissolved in your bloodstream. Therefore, the bends are eliminated.
Now, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to address all sorts of things that we haven't been talking about, like the creation of the National Helium Reserve and why, if we were stockpiling a lot of helium, why there's a shortage right now and what that means, not just to people who are involved with the Macy's Day Parade, but also people who have MRI machines and are involved in other kinds of research. Why is helium so important to them? We'll take a little break and come back with that and your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also write to our show page at WNYC.org. And we are back with today's Please Explain Look at Helium and the reason that there are suddenly shortages of the second most common element in the universe with Joe Peterson, the Federal Bureau of Land Management's Assistant Field Manager for Helium Resources in the Amarillo, Texas Field Office, and Dr. Martin Stutta, Professor of Environmental Science at Barnard College and Adjunct Senior Research Scientist at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. And let's go to Jeffrey from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Jeffrey.
Yes. Good afternoon.
You want to ask the question, Jeffrey?
Well, I want to share a theory I have about helium. And it's a searching question. It's a searching statement. I would like to know, what do the doctors think about helium? You know, since they don't like to, you know, react with other elements, that it may serve as a support for the upper atmosphere.
Okay, so how important is helium to maintaining Earth's atmosphere? Which one of you wants to tackle that?
It's a very small component of the Earth's atmosphere. The concentration is only about 5 parts in a million parts. There is helium coming out of the Earth, as we discussed, producing the Earth. It's going into the atmosphere. But helium is also one of the few elements in the atmosphere that can be lost to space because it's so small and light. It appears at very high speeds in the atmosphere and has enough speed that some of it can leave the atmosphere.
Is it a greenhouse gas?
No, it's not a greenhouse gas. And it's a very minor component, and because of its inertness, it's really not contributing to any reactions in the atmosphere. A typical helium atom stays in the atmosphere for about 1 million years, and then it's lost to space. So it's constantly being replenished by the inner Earth and then lost into space.
Mr. Peterson, when did helium become something that the U.S. government had an interest, started collecting? When did it create the National Helium Reserve?
Well, the reserve was created in about 1960. However, prior to that, in about 1920s and 30s, there was a lot of interest generated from the discoveries that they had made about helium at the end of World War I. And as we moved into the 1930s, we began to discover other locations, or locations throughout the United States, that had a economically recoverable quantity of helium. And as we got into World War II, the properties that helium expressed were so important. And it was during World War II that helium was used as a shield gas for welding aluminum and those very soft metals, titanium metals, metals that were used to make airplanes during World War II. And it was because of those discoveries that they began to even look for more uses of helium.
Do we still use it that way?
Yes, helium is still used as an inert gas shield for arc welding. It's used, we mentioned the party balloons already. It's also used as a cooling medium for nuclear reactors. As a matter of fact, during World War II, if it wasn't for helium, we probably would have never developed the atomic bomb. It was because of helium that we were able to to find a medium that was able to remove the heat from the reactions that occurred without the medium itself becoming radioactive. When you use water as a cooling medium, the water did become radioactive. Because of the inert nature of helium, the helium remained non-radioactive after it was exposed to the radioactive materials.
And Dr. Studa, helium can be lowered in temperature to just 3 degrees above absolute zero?
Yes, so it can be cooled. It is still a gas at 4 degrees above absolute zero, which is in Fahrenheit, minus 452 degrees Fahrenheit. So at low, very
can anything else be lowered that much?
No, everything else becomes a solid much earlier.
And then doesn't helium become a liquid at 3 degrees?
Yes, it is a liquid at that temperature. And that you can actually buy helium as a liquid at that temperature, and that's often used for cooling purposes. If you need to cool something to very, very low temperatures, for example, magnets that are used for MRI instruments, you can use liquid helium, or you can use a compressor to compress helium to very high pressures and then release the pressure, and then helium is cooling these magnets to very low temperatures in that range.
So, Joe Peterson, we have two markets here. We have the government, and then we have private industry and hospitals and all sorts of other people, researchers who use things that involve large magnets, all wanting helium. What has helium been selling for? What kind of price?
Boy, that is a very good question. You know, helium, the price of helium is one of those closely regarded secrets.
I mean, if I open a balloon shop, I can't find out the price?
Well, if you had a balloon shop, yes, you would definitely find out the price. But the thing is, in a balloon shop, you're buying cylinders of helium. Now, a cylinder of helium would probably run you maybe $150 to $175 for a cylinder that's about 3 feet tall, maybe a diameter of 1 foot. Only has about 125 feet of helium in it, though, and it's compressed. Now, if you compare that price with the price of 1,000 cubic feet of helium that's usually sold as a gas that would be used, for example, for lifting gas for a dirigible or an aerostat, something very large, going to use a high volume of helium, you definitely would not pay that same price, that very high price. That you would get in a cylinder. So, you know, because of that, as you go to a larger economy of scale for the amount of helium that you're using, the price changes. Like everything else, though.
Dr. Studa, how is it used in MRIs?
So MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging instruments, they have a big magnets in them, so they create a huge magnetic field that then allows the doctors to look into your head, for example, into your body. And these magnets have currents flowing through them, and they are much more efficient. They can be smaller, and a lot less current is needed if these magnets are cooled to very, very low temperatures. So they become superconducting magnets. That means the current almost flows on its own through these magnets. And in order to get them to these really low temperatures, helium is being used. It's like a refrigerator. You have, but instead of the medium that's used in refrigerators, that's circulating in your refrigerator, use helium. You compress helium to very high pressures, and then it's being released, and it cools in that process to very low temperatures, and it keeps these magnets not far away, not far above this absolute zero temperature that we have been talking about, and that makes these magnets much more efficient.
And then there's magnets are also used in other kinds of research. So if there is a helium shortage, and Mr. Peterson, I'm going to get to that in just a moment, but if there is a helium shortage, does that cause a problem for people who have all of these machines that rely on big magnets? What happens if they don't get the helium?
Boy, the magnets will begin to warm up, and when they do, they become less efficient. And as that happens, the number of MRIs that could be done in a day is reduced significantly. Yes, that is a very significant event. And whenever there is a helium shortage, there's a delay in the amount of time required to get helium to refill those MRI machines.
Now, why is there a helium shortage? There's a lot of it to be gathered, and we were stockpiling it. What happened to our stockpile?
Well, in 1996, Congress passed the Helium Privatization Act. And what that act did was it required the federal government to sell the helium from the Federal Reserve, or to offer for sale helium from the Federal Reserve.
And why did Congress do that?
Well, the thought at the time was that there was enough helium that was in the reserve that would last the federal government for some number of years, and private industry is well able to provide helium in the future. Was the prevailing thought at the time. So Congress passed the legislation, and it said that, you know, the federal government had to sell had to offer for sale 2.1 BCF of helium each year, and that helium would be bought by private refiners, and those refiners would augment their supply of helium and make that helium available to their private customers. There was roughly a 15-year window that would allow the federal government, or that would allow private industry to develop new sources of helium and bring those to market in a manner that would allow them to continuously supply all of the helium requirements in the U.S. and actually throughout the world.
Can you get helium through fracking?
Well, no. In general, the fracking process is usually done at a depth that's not as low as, or not as deep as what helium is usually stored in. And besides that, because of the small nature of the helium, in many cases, that helium has already escaped from whatever reservoirs may be available where fracking would occur.
Now, should we be concerned? Right now, we've sold off the reservoirs. There is talk of a global shortage. We keep on developing new machines that will require helium. I'm assuming that the super collider in Europe that found the Higgs boson uses a lot of helium.
Yes.
So I guess we're not going to see too much helium for balloons anymore. But are we going to have real problems in just doing normal research in the future?
Well, the thing to know really about the helium shortage that we're experiencing is not the fact that we're running out of helium. That is not the case at all. The thing is the availability of helium is the problem. You may not be able to get a cylinder of helium or an ISO container of helium when you want it because of the availability of the resource.
So I have an MRI machine. I call up my supplier. He says, I'm sorry, I don't have anything on stock right now. And then I imagine my magnets melting down. Dr. Stuta, are you concerned?
I'm not so concerned about this in general, because I think what will happen is that prices for helium will go up whenever something is tight in supply. And I think we will all be more careful with using helium. We will not waste it as much. We might think again about recycling helium. In the early days, when helium was a very scarce commodity, actually, in research laboratories, there were balloons hanging under the ceiling where all the helium that was used in the laboratory was collected, it was cleaned up afterwards, and then reused. And we might have to go back to some of those recycling procedures that we have abandoned because helium has been so cheap for such a long time. And also, in the end, you know, that helium that we have been using is going to the atmosphere. It's lost from the atmosphere at a very low rate. So it will be expensive, but we should be able in the future to tap the atmosphere as a resource of helium as well.
And a listener points out, I don't know if it's true, but I assume it is, that Iran has a huge supply of helium, but our sanctions against Iran make it impossible for us to tap that. Do either of you know about that? So politics plays a part in all of this.
politics, yes, does play a part in it. And, yes, there are supplies of helium available in many parts of the world. Iran would be one of them. Another one would be Qatar. As a matter of fact, in Qatar, there is a helium expansion project that's going on now that should be completed by midsummer. And as soon as that occurs, that will be an additional source of helium that we'll have to meet this demand for helium that we have. Also in the United States, there are additional resources that will be coming online probably later this summer that will allow us to alleviate this current shortage that we're in. But at the same time, we have to continue to develop those resources. And private industry has been well adept at creating additional resources over time. Just the current situation that we're in, this 1 or 2 year period when the economy slowed down, the amount of natural gas that was being produced was reduced in locations that had helium in it. And so that resulted in less helium being produced to meet demand.
Well, I talked about MRIs and scientific research. Is it still used a lot in by the U.S. military?
In scientific research, there are applications where the military uses helium. Again, you know, just like it's interesting that just like in 1917 when they used them to observe the enemy in World War I, today there are applications where the military uses dirigibles or aerostats or blimps, you want to use that word, to monitor the activities of people in Afghan in different parts of the country, especially on the border, U.S. border with Mexico.
Well, right now, I guess we should assume we're going to be seeing less of the Doubleday blimp, and maybe the Macy's Day Parade next year may have to make some adjustments. But thank you both much.
It's interesting about the Macy's Day Parade.
We've run out of time.
Okay.
Please Explain Today has been about helium with Joe Peterson, the Federal Bureau of Land Management's Assistant Field Manager for Helium Resources, and Dr. Martin Struder, Professor of Environmental Science at Barnard College. Thank you both so much.